Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 33. I'm going to do 56 verses today, 1 through 56. However, it will be a short audio because most of the chapter is dealing with the stages of Israel's journey, the encampments they made. We're not going to spend a lot of time on that. I'm going to call this chapter, God Tells Israel to Drive Out the Canaanites, because at the very end of the chapter, God has a little talk with Moses and said, Moses, this is what you're to tell the people. They're to drive out the Canaanites. And if you don't do it, it's going to be bad news for you or bad news for Israel. Moses, of course, will be passed on to heaven by then. Our context is this. In chapter 32, we see how Reuben and Gad had decided they liked the prosperous, lush, luxuriant land in Gilead in the Transjordan region to the east of the Jordan River. And so they agree with Moses that, hey, if we'll go over and fight and let the rest of Israel conquer the west of Jordan, if you'll let us come back and settle in the east of Jordan. And Moses said, fine, that's okay. So here we are, Numbers 33, 1 through 2. These are the journeys of the sons of Israel, by which they came out from the land of Egypt by their armies under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Moses recorded their starting places according to their journeys by the command of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their starting places. Starting places means where they left camp from. Now I'm going to give you a little summary of these places that are listed. I'm not going to go through each and individual spot. NIV Study Bible points out that there are 40 places listed, and this suggests a styling of the list. In other words, we're only going to choose 40 to make it an even number of 40. Moses might have done that. For what reason? Well, I speculate maybe he wanted to have one city for each of the 40 years that it took them to get there. I don't know. I guess you could say 40 is always a symbol of travail in the wilderness. As Jesus had 40 days in the wilderness and the Israelites had 40 years in the wilderness, maybe 40 is to emphasize that fact. I don't know. We do know that most of the sites listed are difficult to locate. And the reason for that is most of these sites were desert encampments. They were not cities. There's nothing left for archaeologists to find, as the NIV Study Bible points out. And that is frustrating when you study the Exodus, not knowing exactly which way the Israelites went, and people will debate that till cows come home. Now, some of the places listed here in this chapter are not listed earlier as we went through the Exodus, but some places listed earlier in the book of Exodus and in the book of Numbers too, for that matter, some of those places are not listed here, as the NIV Study Bible says. So the names don't match up in this rehash one-on-one with the earlier listings of the places. Adam Clark says that Numbers is the first travel book ever published. That's clever. I guess it is. Now, the listing of these places winds up the story of the travels in the wilderness. The next three chapters, the last three chapters in Numbers, will talk about the dividing up of the land. Who gets what? Which tribe gets what? Now, in this listing in chapter 33 of these 40 places, only the most important places are listed. There, of course, there were other places not listed. Now, one thing about the listing of all these places, as hard as they might be for archaeologists to find some of them, but the listing of these places keeps modern readers from thinking that the Exodus was a fairy tale. Now, I realize that there are some liberals. They think the resurrection of the dead was a fairy tale. And that's why they're not Christians, and that's why they are in dire need of salvation, and that's why we ought not to listen to those people. But I do know that I just can see it now. If the account of the Exodus were like this, Israel left Egypt, and after many years, they ended up in Canaan, people would say, oh, that's just a fairy tale. We can't find the archaeology. Now, there is a lot of archaeology, by the way. It's quite interesting down there in Egypt that makes it look like Israel was in the land of Goshen. But the archaeological evidence is not slam dunk so that people don't debate exactly which way the Israelites went on the Exodus. But at least the fact that all these places are listed makes it sound very much like an account, a narrative, not like a fairy tale. Now in verse 2, a command is mentioned. Moses recorded their starting places according to their journeys by the command of the Lord. Now what's by the command of the Lord? The fact that Moses is supposed to record the places and write it down? Is that the command of the Lord? Or is it that the journeys were commanded by the Lord? Well, I don't know what Moses meant here. The text is ambiguous. But they were both commanded by the Lord, both the writing down of the text and also the journeys that the text recorded. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that the writing down was important because it was important to have an historical record of such an incredible happening. After all, we're still reading about it 3.5 millennia later, and Cecil B. DeMille made that great movie that everybody knows about with Charlton Heston as Moses. We're still talking about this, The Exodus. Leon Uris wrote that great novel, The Exodus. Everybody knows about The Exodus. So it was good that Moses wrote it down. Now we start here in Numbers 33:3-4. They journeyed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the next day after the Passover. The sons of Israel started out boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians. While the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them, the Lord had also executed judgments on their gods. Now Ramses was the city in Egypt that was the starting place of the Exodus. The archaeologists know where Ramses is. If you look at a map, I've got a BibleAtlas.org map, you'll see going from south to north, the Nile River goes up, and right when it gets to On, right past the Great Pyramids, On is in present-day Cairo, the Nile splits into three main branches that mosey on down to the Mediterranean Sea, and the rightmost, or the easternmost branch, is called the Bubastic Branch. Now, if you go up that Bubastic Branch, you get about halfway from Cairo to the Mediterranean Sea, halfway from On, also known as Heliopolis, from On to the Mediterranean Sea, you see Ramses. Now, let me read you from the description of Ramses in BibleAtlas.org. Ramses was, quote, one of the two settlements built or built up by the Hebrews for the Pharaoh, the other being Pithom, to which the Septuagint adds a third, namely On, which is in Heliopolis, a town near Cairo. That's interesting that the Septuagint puts that one in there, too, but I don't know how that happened. But anyway, we got at least these two, Pithom and Ramses. The Hebrew term Mikanoth, which describes the settlement or the city that we're talking about here, the Hebrew term Mikanoth comes from a root meaning to settle down, but it is rendered strong cities in the Septuagint, treasure cities in the King James Version, and incorrectly store cities in the Revised Version. That's the Revised Standard Version. The land of Ramses, where Jacob and his sons settled, was apparently the field of Zoan, thus lying in the delta east of the Bubastic branch of the Nile. So think Bubastic branch, think Ramses halfway up to the Mediterranean Sea, go east of that a little bit, and there's your field of Zoan, which is mentioned a lot in the Old Testament. So that's where they started from. They started in the first month in verse 3. That, of course, is the month of Nisan, which is our March and April. Remember, it was Passover time, springtime, March or April. They left on the 15th because Nisan 14th was Passover. After they killed the lamb and ate it and had the meal, the next day comes around and they take off. They don't wait to take too much time to leave, of course. So they left on the 15th, and it states that explicitly in verse 3 here, Numbers 33. On the next day after the Passover, the sons of Israel started out boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians. Now that was bold. The whole slave population says, we're leaving, guys. See you later. They weren't afraid at first, but of course things changed drastically after that. They were always complaining, oh, we want to go back to Egypt. We were safe and secure with the leeks and the garlics and the soft cushions. Yeah, they were slaves, but they idealized their slave past is something they wanted to go back to because they were scared. That happened all the time on the journey through the Exodus, but not at first. They were very bold. It says right here, explicitly, verse 3, they started out boldly. Now, I assume that the 10 plagues probably had a lot to do with their attitude. They saw God wipe out Egypt one after the other, and Moses holding his staff up, and all the plagues coming on Egypt. That would make one bold. Nonetheless, as bold as you are, how do you get out of Egypt when you're a slave? Not only you, but about 2 million other Jews. How do you get out? Well, it says right here in verse 4 that they left while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn. Now, here we get a clue as to how they got out, the Jews did, how they got out. Because the Egyptians were so busy dealing with the horrible calamity of watching their descendants, their future, wiped out. And they're crying, and they're moaning, and they're weeping, and they're burying all their firstborn, going through the funeral rites that they have to do, you know, because they believe they went up to their ancestors. They have to do all this stuff, taking care of all the dead people. And the last thing on their minds is a bunch of Hebrew slaves. And so the Jews just packed up and left. Plus, they were a little bit far to the north and east, away from the main going-ons down there and on, or wherever the capital was. I can't remember where the capital was. I don't think anybody knows exactly where the capital was at that time, but wherever it was further south, and the Hebrews were a little bit further away from them, and they're leaving while everybody else in Egypt is burying their dead. So that makes sense. And then there's this comment in verse 4, the Lord had also executed judgment on their gods. Not only their firstborn, they got judged, but also their gods. Now, gods in the Old Testament, when you see that word, it can either mean your typical idolatrous god, or it can also mean rulers, your kings and your princes, like Joe Biden is our god. Oh, pains me to say that, the day after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. But that's how the word is used a lot. You know, you are gods. But here I think it means idols, because God destroyed the idols. And many commentators on the Exodus point out that when the frogs were all over the land, that was a judgment on the frog god and so forth. You can find an Egyptian god that matched all the plagues. Of course, that's not really too hard to do, because the Egyptians worshipped anything that moved. But at any rate, that's a good send-off for the Jews. And then we see in Numbers 33, verses 5 through 48, the listing of all the places they stopped at. Verse 5, then the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses and camped in Succoth. So from Succoth on down, you can follow that on a map. Remember, the maps are conjectural, done by scholars. We're not going to read all these places. We've already been through many of these places as we went through the Pentateuch earlier. Now we get down to chapter 33, verses 50 through 56, and we'll wind up this chapter. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. They've already gotten up to the plains of Jericho. They've wiped out the Midianites in the last chapter, and so they're just getting ready to cross over. Joshua's going to take them over. So God tells Moses, saying, verse 51, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their figured stones, and destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land for you to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides. And they will trouble you in the land in which you live. And as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you. Now this is a speech that God puts in Moses' mouth. He wants Moses to deliver this speech to the people. And this speech is especially important, as the NIV Study Bible says, because Moses is about to die. These are his parting instructions, kind of like an oral testament, if you will. The Israelites needed instructions. They needed directions. Now the main thrust of the speech is, Israel, I want you to drive out the Canaanites. Now remember, Israel had just whopped the Midianites, and what Moses is saying, what you just did to the Midianites, I want you to do to the Canaanites too. And of course, as the NIV Study Bible points out, and John Gill points out, that all this driving out of the Canaanites was to be done not at once, but gradually. Of course, it's too hard to drive out a whole bunch of pagans who are settled in their land. You don't do that in a day. It's going to take a while. I've got a good application point here. How well does the new Israel, the church, drive out idolatry in the modern era? Not so good, in my humble opinion. Well, we know as we read, when we get to the book of Joshua, we'll know that the Israelites didn't do so hot. They left pagans all over the land, and those pagans became as pricks in their eyes. And I'll tell you, all the idolatry that we've left here in America is coming back to haunt the church. Coming back to haunt us. Verse 52, God tells Moses to destroy all the Canaanites' molten images and demolish all their high places. What's a high place? Well, the Canaanites, of course, routinely put idolatrous groves and shrines up on the high hills. That's where they went up to carry out their idolatry, to offer their sacrifices, and so forth. Now, in verse 55, God tells Moses, but if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land before you, well, now, what could they do if they don't drive them out? Well, they could go in there and they could make business covenants with them, as John Gill suggests, or they could go in and intermarry with them. Now, isn't that always? It is just amazing to me. If you want to get idolatry into a people, marry the wrong type of girl. Marry the pagan girls or the pagan men. Marry them, and you'll be so sorry. And this is what you see happening all the time. I got to get married, so I'm going to marry me a pagan. I've lived in China for so long and saw this happen so many times. In fact, there was this one young Chinese, I guess she was about 22 years old, and she was on fire for God, and she was so bold. And she, in fact, while she was there, she ended up in jail, not for preaching the gospel, but for some misunderstanding, but she got put in jail for her outspokenness, and she was really something. And of course, I was attracted to that, and so I got to know her a little bit, started talking to her. She actually came out to my house in South Carolina on her trip to America, and then all of a sudden, I hear that she's dating somebody, and then when I talk to her, I find out the guy's not a Christian, and she says, God's led me. He leads me in strange ways. I said, does he lead you to violate the scripture? Is God self-contradictory? I was pretty ticked off about it. And so I haven't talked to her in years because of her compromise. And this happens all the time in China, especially with the girls, because of all the pressure from the culture. You got to get married at 30. And if you're not married at 30, you are a worthless pile of excrement. And we don't ever want to see you again because you're not giving us sons. You're not giving us descendants. You know, that's their culture. And it's unfortunate and I hate it, but I don't care what the excuse is. Don't marry a person who is not an on fire, dedicated disciple and follower of Jesus, or you will be sorry because you will introduce paganism into your family. And then if that happens too much, then the paganism ends up in your culture. And then bad, bad things happen after that. You'll end up like America, a totally pagan and sin-besotted country. Now, God tells Moses in verse 56, he says, as I plan to do to them, to the Canaanites, I will do to you. If you don't drive these Canaanites out, what I do to the Canaanites, I'm going to do to the Israelites. Well, what did God do to the Canaanites? Well, there's some options on this. It could be God is saying, look, I'm going to make the Canaanites captives to invading peoples, and I'm going to do the same thing to you, Israel. And that, of course, then would refer to what happened to the northern Israelites in 722 BC when the Assyrians carried them off, and what happened to the southern Israelites in 586 BC when the Babylonians carried them into captivity, finally, after a couple of previous raids on Israel, carrying the people into captivity. And then in 586, the whole city was destroyed. So that could be option number one. Here's actually three options. God can make Israel captive in the promised land, like he makes the Canaanites captive to other people in the promised land. Option number two, he could carry Israel captive into other lands, even as he's going to carry local Canaanites into captivity. The Assyrians did that to the local Canaanites. And option number three, he's going to exterminate the pagans just like he's going to exterminate the Israelites just as he exterminated the pagan Canaanites. Well, that's Clark's idea, the extermination idea. I don't think he's right, but he says that this is basically a mutually exclusive option that Israel is faced with. You either expel all those Israelites or you're going to die. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown quote Deuteronomy 7:1 to back this up. They say, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. Well, that verse just says that God is going to clear away nations before you. It doesn't say exterminate. It says clear away. Well, does that mean exterminate or just driven into slavery? That verse doesn't really clearly say extermination. It does imply it, though, because when you clear out the paganites, it implies that you've killed them. But the language here in Numbers 33, 50 through 56 is driving out the inhabitants, not doing mass genocide. So I don't think God is saying, just like I'm going to kill all the Canaanites, we're going to kill all the Israelites. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think that's an extreme view that Clark has. I think that basically what he's saying is, you don't drive out the Canaanites, well, I'm going to make them captive, and you're going to be captive just like they are. And as a matter of fact, the Assyrians and the Babylonians did, those empires did make the Canaanites in just a few hundred years later, did make them captives and did drive them out of the country, especially with the Assyrians as they switched the populations around the empire. But at any rate, that's neither here nor there. The point is Israel, you better drive out the pagans. You better not make covenants with them. You better not intermarry with them. Wipe them out. You are too prone to idolatry. Look at this incident at the Baal of Peor. You ended up shacking up with all the Moabite and Midianite women who were seducing you to worship of a false god and to turn your heart away from me, bringing eternal damnation on yourself. I don't trust you people. I don't trust you. You need to follow me and not the pagan gods. So drive them out. It's a great speech. That's the end of Numbers 33. We are now prepared to go to Numbers 34. And in that chapter, verses 1 through 29, we will see the boundaries of the tribes laid out and described for Israel. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.